This is The Health Show, a presentation of National Productions.
It's widely known that October is Breast Cancer Awareness Month. There are many programs and articles devoted to the topic of breast cancer treatment and detection all month long. We did one last week, we'll do another next week. But what you may not know is that September was Prostate Cancer Awareness Month.
Not every biopsy which identifies cancer needs treatment.
On today's Health Show, okay, we may be a little late, but we'll learn more about this disease that kills thousands of men each year.
We'll also find out about the major cause of childhood diarrhea and dehydration in the world, the rotavirus, and hear how a returning soldier with PTSD learned to cope with his problem on film. I'm Dr. Nina Sachs.
I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Health Show. You may not realize it, but there's a bit of a battle going on in the medical community about prostate cancer. For years, men have been screened for prostate cancer using the prostate-specific antigen, or PSA test. But in recent years, the value of the PSA test has been questioned by many, including Dr. Otis Brawley, the American Cancer Society's chief medical and scientific officer. So what's a middle to not so middle-aged man to do? We ask this and other questions about prostate cancer to Dr. Christopher Rose, a practicing radiation oncologist in Los Angeles and the chief technical officer at Vantage Oncology. Dr. Rose is a member of the Medicare Coverage Advisory Commission and vice chair of the NCI-sponsored Quality Research in Radiation Oncology Study. We spoke recently and I asked him about the conflicting information about screening for prostate cancer.
Well, unfortunately, I don't think there is conventional wisdom anymore. The situation has been, I think, highlighted. I'm not so sure it was improved by some of the controversies and problems that we have in identifying what are prostate cancers that require treatment as a result of the inability of the specialty to entirely define the patients who need treatment. The U.S. Preventive Health Task Force has come down hard on not doing routine screening with a PSA in an attempt to decrease treatment-related morbidity. I personally think, and many of the cancer doctors, the radiation oncologists, medical oncologists, and urologists who I deal with, as well as our specialty societies, think that that's a wrong-headed approach. And what really needs to be done is to have conversations with patients about the meaning of an elevated PSA, as well as the meaning of the finding of a diagnosis of cancer. Not every elevated PSA needs a biopsy, and not every biopsy which identifies cancer needs treatment. And it's a complicated situation, but to walk away from that and say that patients should not be screened, I think is going to result in more cancer deaths in the United States than what was previously noted, both during and prior to the era of routine PSA screening.
It certainly is a condition where communication between doctor and patient is about as important as it could possibly be.
That's right, and there is uncertainty. That's why the physician needs to take his time. And for patients, this is particularly difficult because the patient is going to walk away from that conversation without certainty. And medical uncertainty, I think, is something that we as physicians haven't explained to patients, that there is such a thing or that there is so much of it. But if you think about this, this goes back forever. 20, 25 years ago, I'm reading in the New England Journal of Medicine that the so-called diet-health connection had been debunked and that indeed diet was not associated with increased heart disease. And look what's happened with that. So things go back and forth. It isn't quite the pendulum that I think that the lay press says, but there is medical uncertainty. But, you know, for me, 30,000 men die of prostate cancer each year, and before PSA screening, there was 10,000 more deaths. And to me, there's no more prima facie evidence that screening works than that.
Can you talk to a patient or get a history from a patient and say, well, this is somebody who should definitely be screened? Is family history that important?
Well, I think that if a patient has got a family history of prostate cancer and has an elevated PSA, that's a patient who should be screened. I think that something called PSA kinetics, which is to say the rate of rise of the PSA, is something that also alerts me to the need for additional testing, which essentially means biopsy. although there is an intermediate test, which is less than biopsy, that is sometimes helpful. Beyond the rate of rise of the PSA, I mean, African Americans have a much higher incidence of prostate cancer. So if they have PSAs that are elevated, and then, of course, obviously, if patients have abnormalities on digital rectal exam, that's another tip-off that something needs to be done.
There are genetic tests for breast cancer. We've all heard about the BRCA genes. Is there anything like that now or on the horizon for prostate cancer?
We don't have one test. There's not a BRCA gene, but there are genetic profiles, that is to say, looking at a number of different genes, which help predict for the aggressivity of prostate cancer. And this really is the holy grail, obviously. I mean, there's no dispute that patients with so-called high-risk prostate cancer, patients whose glands are highly involved with the tumor on rectal exam, whose PSAs are greater than 20 and whose Gleason grade, which is how the cells look under the microscope, is high, that those patients need treatment. And for most patients with what's called intermediate risk prostate cancer, most of those patients who need treatment. But there are some patients with intermediate risk prostate cancer and some patients, and almost all patients with low risk prostate cancer, who can be observed, who can have their PSAs checked and have repeat biopsies in the future in an attempt to determine whether or not they need treatment. And this would be made so much simpler if we had a widespread and validated genetic profile testing. And this work is going on right now in many academic centers. And I think that the nice thing is that, we're going to get this answer within the next 2 to 5 years. And then this whole issue of screening is bad is going to go away.
Well, let's get to treatment, because part of the fear of prostate cancer is that the treatment can be worse. Well, the disease will kill you, but the treatment can be pretty bad with side effects after you're done.
That's correct. And again, we need to have conversations with patients, because I believe that in our desire to be comforting with patients, we're not realistic about this. And there's hardly any patient whose both urinary function and sexual function is better after the treatment than before the treatment. And, it's like, doctor, can I play the piano after you're done doing the treatment? And if they couldn't play the piano beforehand, they're not going to be able to do it afterwards. But both in terms of what I do as a radiation oncologist and what the surgeons do, it's my belief that the probability of having erectile dysfunction and the probability of having incontinence are much reduced compared with even 5 years ago. And, and there are certainly papers coming from the large institutions that treat patients. Certainly in my field of radiation oncology, there's a whole slew of them showing better functioning. But it's true. These are risks. They have to be weighed against the probability of being cured at the other side. And again, for patients with intermediate and high-risk prostate cancer, where the probability of having disability or death as a result of the treatment is not insignificant, the risk is worth the benefit. For low-risk patients, where the probability of dying with the cancer rather than of the cancer, it may be that treatment is inappropriate.
How targeted have the treatments become in your field, radiation oncology? It's no longer you just blast everything. You can really hone in on things now, right?
Well, first of all, many patients can be treated with a totally targeted treatment, a radiation implant. And that's a minimally invasive surgical procedure where radiation pellets, either temporary or permanent, are placed into the gland and only the gland is irradiated. So that's a highly targeted treatment. But the large majority of patients in the U.S. are treated with machines that deliver the radiation from the outside. And what is new in radiation is that we now have methods of instantaneously seeing where the gland is in three-dimensional space, knowing where it's supposed to be, moving the patients in such a way as the gland is targeted, and then using radiation modalities that are much more precise in terms of putting the dose into the gland and minimizing the dose outside of the gland. That method of delivering the dose is called intensity-modulated radiation therapy, or IMRT. There's a whole collective methods of imaging the gland prior to and during the treatment, and that series of technologies is called image-guided radiation therapy. And the combination of image-guided radiation therapy and intensity-modulated radiation has been shown to markedly decrease urinary complications in a recent study that was in our specialty journal from the Memorial Sloan Kettering. And my own group has been doing image-guided radiation therapy since about 2006, and we were able to show a marked decrease in rectal toxicity. The Sloan Kettering group, with a much larger group of patients, was also able to show improvement in cure rates with the high-risk patients with the use of this IGRT. So I'm very optimistic that, you know, radiation is an intermediary technology. In 1974, when I started, people said, well, you're going to be out of business, so why are you going into cancer therapy? I wish that was the case. It isn't up to now, but I think that, you know, until such a time as they invent that magic pill, and I don't think that day is too far down the road, we have these intermediary treatments, you know, surgery and radiation, that are increasingly less toxic.
Dr. Christopher Rose is a practicing radiation oncologist in Los Angeles and the chief technical officer at Vantage Oncology.
Still to come, the worldwide fight against diarrhea in children has a new target. That story's next on The Health Show.
You can find The Health Show anytime online at healthshow.org. Search the archive and listen to whole programs you may have missed or would like to hear again. Even subscribe to our podcast. That's healthshow.org. You can also follow us on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/thehealthshow.
You can start your own Health Show archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for Health Show number 1280.
This is The Health Show. I'm Bob Barrett.
And I'm Dr. Nina Sachs.
Every child has a bout of diarrhea or two. Here in the U.S., for the most part, it's an inconvenience that's easily treatable. But in the developing world, it continues to be life-threatening. Decades of research on childhood diarrhea has revealed its main cause and new ways to prevent its occurrence on a global scale. Margot Kern from the National Institutes of Health has a report.
Childhood diarrhea remains one of the major causes of death in the developing world. Dr. Roger Glass, director of NIH's Fogarty International Center, reflects on how our understanding of childhood diarrhea has changed over the past several decades.
We've discovered the most important agent of diarrhea in children, rotavirus. Not only have we discovered it, but it's led to a number of vaccines that have come forward, a recognition of its importance globally, and the first efforts to eliminate and prevent this severe childhood infection through the use of a vaccine, both in the United States and in the developing world.
Dr. Glass explains that infection with rotavirus can be serious if not properly treated.
Rotavirus is the most common cause of severe diarrhea in children worldwide. It affects every child in the first few years of life. Most kids get a diarrheal episode. And for some of those children, this episode can be severe and can be fatal if they're not properly treated. So it's a huge problem. It's a universal problem. All kids have it. Rich or poor, black or white, Chinese or American or African, we all share the same common infection.
Since the discovery of rotavirus, highly effective vaccines have been generated.
In the United States, we rolled out rotavirus most recently in 2006. And over the past 5 years, we've seen a tremendous reduction in hospitalizations of children for diarrhea, especially in the winter. About a 50% reduction in diarrheal disease, 95% reduction in rotavirus. And this has led to a decrease in hospitalizations that we estimate to be about 5% of all children under five. That is a huge advance and a huge savings to the hospitals and to the public.
Introduction of the vaccine around the world is now the main focus.
Globally, we see that there are around 500,000 deaths from rotavirus among children in the developing world, mostly in low-income countries. the first effort to reduce mortality, deaths, in the developing country was documented in Mexico, where the vaccine was introduced, and 3 years later, the Mexicans, together with CDC, were able to document about a 40% reduction in diarrheal deaths in Mexican children. We still have a 500,000 deaths from rotavirus in the world today. And the real goal of these programs will be to see how much of this we can eliminate through the use of the vaccine in the years ahead.
Dr. Glass says the field has changed dramatically since he began studying childhood diarrhea.
You know, when I began working on rotavirus and diarrheal diseases, it wasn't a sexy topic. It's really hard to picture a child with diarrheal disease. It's not like a child with polio where they have a physical ailment. A child with diarrheal disease is dehydrated, is vomiting, may be covered with poop. It's not a very pleasant sight. And there is not a lot of recognition of its importance. Over the years, we've developed very simple ways to document the importance of rotavirus among hospitalized children. And using that documentation, we were able to make a case for the use of the vaccine in the United States and throughout the world. So rotavirus vaccination has been embraced by the World Health Organization as a priority disease, by the Global Alliance for Vaccines and Immunization, and earliest by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, which saw this as one of the prime reasons that they began investing in vaccines for child survival.
NIH's Fogarty International Center is leading the way in rotavirus research.
Here at Fogarty, we invest in capacity building of scientists, young scientists in the developing world, to be able to do their own research, to help them with methods, to help them make new discoveries and observations. We really feel that the frontiers of science are not only in the United States, but are in all the corners of the world. We share common problems, just like rotavirus, which is a universal infection.
For more about the Fogarty International Center, visit fic.nih.gov. And to learn more about rotavirus and rotavirus vaccines, visit niaid.nih.gov. For NIH Radio, I'm Margot Kern.
Sergeant Matthew Pennington was injured while serving on combat duty in Iraq. He showed signs of PTSD, but is working toward recovery by promoting self-identification of these symptoms for other veterans after his appearance in a short fictional film about an Iraq war vet. Damian Biniak from the Salt Institute for Documentary Studies has a report.
When Sergeant Matthew Pennington signed up for his third tour of duty in the Army, he wanted a more active combat role. He signed up to be a machine gunner, riding atop a Humvee as an escort for military convoys headed up and down the eastern side of Iraq.
Like being in Mad Max, it was, you know, you on the open highway, sitting behind a gun, cruising down the road.
As combat increased, he soon found that it wasn't so much like the movies after all. In April of 2006, Matthew was asked to drive the lead vehicle of a convoy headed south towards Balad. As he prepped his gear for the trip, he tucked his tourniquet into his uniform.
It was just like an eerie feeling just kind of fell on that night. You know, it was just something didn't seem right.
Halfway through the drive, the headlights in Matthew's Humvee shorted out, and he was left with a single left side low beam light. He was driving at about 50 miles per hour when he spotted a small homemade bomb in the dim light ahead. But the road was too narrow, and there was no way to get around it.
So there's, you know, no escape.
Matthew stepped on the gas, trying to put as much of the engine's solid mass over the blast as possible.
After the explosion, I tried to hit the brakes, and I felt that I didn't have anything down there and stuff.
Some shrapnel had torn through the floorboards of the Humvee, shattering his right leg and amputating his left leg just above the foot. Not wanting to look at the wound, he reached for his tourniquet and tied off his left leg. Matthew received emergency care and was eventually transported to Walter Reed Army Medical Hospital in Washington, D.C. Not only did they treat his battle wounds, but they also diagnosed him with post-traumatic stress disorder.
Before I got hurt, we'd already been through 3 or 4 bombs. We'd been shot at by snipers, you know, we'd been in firefights. So it was by that point, it was just kind of like, you start really thinking about how many times, you know, you've came near close to death, then, you know, it's like, it'll really weigh on your mind.
When he returned home to the state of Maine, Matthew found it difficult to settle back into civilian life. As he drove the roads around his home, he was looking for roadside bombs and tripwires along the road. He couldn't go to the grocery store or crowded places without feeling anxious. He also found himself to be easily irritated and untrusting of strangers. He was constantly on edge.
You'll have things that'll trigger you, remind you, you know, it's all of a sudden a car commercial comes on and he's flying through the desert. And then you're like, oh, desert. Oh, wait, Iraq. Oh, man, now I'm thinking about it. And then it's like, okay, wait. And then it's just, so you're constantly stressing about things. And that's a lot of the disorder is.
Matthew had a lot of social interaction at Walter Reed, taking marketing classes and going to many things they put together for the soldiers being treated there. At home in Maine, however, he was far removed from the local Veterans Affairs office. They were frequently behind on his paperwork, which complicated getting full coverage for his benefits and attentive treatment.
I don't understand how they expect somebody going through that to be proactive in taking care of their own self when clearly they've got PTSD and they're not doing that.
Even when his paperwork was sorted out, the care they were giving him wasn't helping him. He was still depressed and stressed out. Matthew needed to find another way. In 2009, he learned about a casting call for a short film about an Iraq war vet. Director Nicholas Brennan had interviewed other war veterans and wrote a short fictional account of a Marine returning home to a small Maine town and coming to terms with his own PTSD. I spoke to him by phone.
We had to find a young male who was an amputee, who was a veteran, who was ideally from New England, or, you know, it would be great if he's from Maine. You know, who can act.
Although Matthew had never acted before, the director knew he was a good fit.
It was pretty clear as soon as we really started going that there was a lot there with Matthew and that he was sort of looking for an outlet for himself.
In this scene from A Marine's Guide to Fishing, Matthew's character has a PTSD episode while he's attempting to fix a boat engine. He's approached by an imaginary superior officer.
Damn it, Lance Corporal! What the hell are you trying to pull?
All due respect, Staff Sergeant. Doing the best I can. This could take a while.
A while?
I never expected to like film. I never expected to really care for the arts or even really, you know, think about it. I loved drawing growing up. I loved playing music. But, you know, that was really about where it went to. So I figured, you know, well, I got PTSD and this is a horrible place for me to go, you know, so let's go do it. Let's get through this.
The experience was better than therapy. In playing the part of the fictional Connor Sullivan, Matthew saw parallels with his own life and came to his own realizations about his PTSD.
The part I most identified with was when he was fishing and he was having intrusive thoughts, because that was a problem I'd have a lot, as I would be going about my normal day and then all of a sudden I'm thinking about this thing in Iraq.
Matthew has since begun touring with the film, presenting lectures for other veterans who have had a chance to watch the project. He wants to bring it to other former soldiers suffering from trauma and PTSD as a way of communicating with them. He hopes that vets in a similar situation can self-identify some internal issues they may not have otherwise seen within themselves, like he did.
That's kind of, I think, one of the best approaches to take is kind of why we do it. You know, it's better than confronting them or, you know, trying to shove it down their throat. If they can see it, realize it within themselves, you know, they're much more likely to succeed.
Matthew found a way to move forward through this film project, but for him, the camera wasn't the cure. It was what was in front of the lens that could really fix him. By accepting how he had changed, he was able to move forward in healing his issues with PTSD. I'm Damien Bignac.
That's all the time we have for this week's Health Show. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at healthshow.org. You can explore the archive for any programs you might have missed or would like to hear again. You can also subscribe to our podcast. That's healthshow.org.
Want more? Then follow us on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/thehealthshow. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is letters@healthshow.org.
I'm Bob Barrett.
And I'm Dr. Nina Sachs.
Stay healthy and be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Health Show.
Dr. Nina Sachs is a practicing member of the American College of Gastroenterology. Bob Barrett is producer of The Health Show. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Health Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content.